This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. We're a nation of immigrants, but is it time to put the brakes on? In this Big Ideas, that's the question for debate. Should we curb immigration? Surveys suggest that most Australians support immigration and see the benefits, but we're worried about the capacity to absorb the rapidly growing population. According to an ANU poll, the downside is traffic gridlock and overcrowding in capital cities, housing prices and environmental damage. Directing migrants to regional towns is one solution. The Prime Minister recently announced new regional visas for skilled migrants and a modest cut in permanent migration. Is this a good move? Are we now on the right track? This IQ debate comes from the Sydney Town Hall, hosted by Dr. Simon Longstaff, the Executive Director of the Ethics Centre. Arguing against a cut in immigration, Dr. Anne Ali, currently the Labor member for Cowan in Western Australia and formerly an academic and specialist in counter-terrorism, and Professor Nicole Gurran, an urban planner from the University of Sydney. Arguing in favour of curbing immigration, Satya Maya, writer and director of policy at the Australian Taxpayers Alliance, and environmental scientist Dr. Jonathan Sobels, a senior research fellow at the University of South Australia. Dr. Sobels was commissioned by the Department of Immigration and Citizenship to study the environmental impact of population growth. He's the first speaker for the affirmative.
My particular train of thought is very much about an immigrant, not as an immigrant as a label, but as a human being. So what I say tonight will not have any particular bias one way or another about how we classify people. That said, our population has reached 25 million people some 24 years ahead of projections made in 2002. At time, the average intake was about 70,000 people per annum. Then the government took the handbrake off. And in the last 5 years, we've averaged over 215,000 net overseas migrants. Then just last week, as I'm sure you're aware, Prime Minister Morrison gently released the brakes a bit when he announced the official immigration cap would go down to 160,000 net overseas migrants. The primary reasons given were essentially traffic congestion being at crisis levels, infrastructure lagging, and livability at risk. And some of these problems are in marginal electorates. Who knew? I'm a geographer who's interested in people and place. The outstanding feature of our migration is the pattern of settlement. From World War II, 80% of migrants have settled in only 20% of our local government areas, particularly and obviously Western Sydney, certainly parts of Melbourne and Perth. 60% of our total population growth comes from migrants. So they make a very big difference in particular locations. For example, Western Sydney will house another 185,000 households over the next 15 or so years, the majority of whom are likely to be migrants. And it's interesting to note the forces of family, culture, and jobs are far more powerful in locating people and of much longer time scales than wishful thinking about moving people, migrants, to regional centres. It's wishful because how many times can we recreate a Canberra year after year? Perhaps Albury-Wodonga would be a better choice instead. So what's the major rationale that we get for immigration beyond our humanitarian intake? It's an economic argument that because more migrants boost our population, they increase total consumption and therefore wealth. But this is contested. Indeed, economist Professor Judith Sloan has said that there is no correlation between population growth and GDP per person. She states that there are many countries with reasonable standards of living without high levels of immigration or indeed population growth. More rapid immigration to our already enormous cities comes with costs, most of which are not calculated by economists. They are called externalities. Examples include habitat loss, species extinction, pollution, congestion, health costs of heat, loss of social cohesion, and lack of access to services for less wealthy people who are consigned to the outer suburbs because of the high house prices. It is simply assumed that we can ensure the abundance, reliability, and quality of fresh water, fresh food, and a livable environment, and that we can deal with the rubbish generated by our consumption at twice the rate of our population growth, just by the way. But no one ever seems to ask the questions. At what point will we stop? How many people are enough? And how do we get off this treadmill of more growth and more growth? Why don't we address the cause as well as the symptoms? The economic arguments literally trample over the physical natural environment as just another engineering problem. Technology seems to keep us treading water, so to speak, solving the problems created by the fact of more people. The numbers of new migrants are like waves that dump you at the beach as we are getting smashed. Are we complaining about the sand in our bathers? If we are still swimming, are we drowning or waving? So what are some of these physical natural consequences? Let's take Western Sydney as an example. Fresh food. In terms of the new suburbs in the northwest and southwest growth corridors, they will pave over 52% of the existing market gardens. Sydney is fast becoming a food desert. It's more vulnerable. Only 4% of your fresh fruit and vegetables is actually produced within 150 kilometres of where you live. There are about 2 days worth of fresh food actually sitting in Sydney at the moment. What odds a bushfire, or a flood, or a cyclone? And as we deliberately create these new vulnerabilities, are we drowning or waving? Western Sydney's growth corridors will also demand more water. But there is no more water in the Hawkesbury, Nepean, or Shoalhaven systems to cater for this rise in population when in drought. Why? Because the capacity of the Warragamba is not enough to guarantee supply during severe drought. Therefore, at a state level, we've had to engineer more water. The desalination plant at Kurnell is being switched on as we speak. Well, if 4 to 6 months can be called a switch. Sydney sends over 1 million tonnes of household rubbish each year to Woodlawn's decommissioned coal mine. You generate 6 million tonnes of household waste a year. So we don't drown in our own rubbish. We send it away. We're literally, quite literally, shitting in our own nests. In conclusion, I suggest that we are drowning in the immigration wave because it is concentrated population. We're getting dumped. As the government has belatedly emerged, coughing and spluttering from the experience, it has realised that the rate of immigration has actually caused problems in our costs of living, social cohesion, and quality of life. Australia is dry, hot, variable, old, with very limited space where people can live with abundant, reliable, high-quality resources. We use up available water, we pave over good soils, we pollute our landscape. We don't swim between the flags anymore. Will we ever learn respect for our place within the biosphere?
Professor Nicole Gurran is an urban planner and housing policy expert based at the University of Sydney School of Architecture, Design and Planning. She presented her solutions to population growth and Australia's housing crisis at the last TEDx Sydney. Please welcome her.
Thank you, Simon, and everyone. Look, I'd like to say first that I absolutely share my colleagues' concern for the environment. Not so much the waves of migrants drowning us, I should get it right, at the beach. But as I was listening to his remarks, I was kind of reminded of the scene in my own house this morning. My daughter was in the bathroom and my son was, you know, banging on the door for her to get out. She calls out, "I was here first." Now my son said, "No one needs to take a 40-minute shower." And, you know, the environment's like that. We've got to stop doing the same thing. We can't metaphorically close the door. We actually need to take real action on the environment and on many of the problems that my colleague pointed out. But blaming immigration for our environmental policy failures has got to stop. And it's the absolute same with cities and housing. We need a step change in urban and housing policy in Australia. Rather than putting the fix on immigrants, we need to call out the real problem: politicians and the sorry state of national political debate. No, I'm very sorry if there are any politicians in the room. I do not mean to cause offence. You're not all the same. To start, I want to define the proposition for tonight's debate that we should curb immigration. Now, the Cambridge Dictionary tells us that to curb means to control or limit something that's not wanted. And when people talk about immigration and say it's not wanted, what they normally mean is it's the effects of immigration, not immigrants themselves, that aren't welcome. For instance, just last week, our Prime Minister announcing those cuts to immigration said, and I'll read this out, "Just because Australians are frustrated about traffic jams and population pressures encroaching on their way of life does not mean that they are anti-migrant or racist." Now, I agree that being frustrated by the traffic or worried about housing affordability isn't racist. But we've normalised a narrative that's too close to racism by persisting with the idea that immigration causes urban congestion or encroaches on our way of life. By the way, Australian politicians have promised to fix traffic congestion since basically forever. Search the newspaper archives and you'll find more than 20,000 articles about traffic problems. The headlines start around the time private cars were introduced. But in those days, people were blaming traffic congestion on the trams. Well, we know where that led. Just like traffic, you'll get a headline by saying Australia can't cope with more immigration. I watched the 60 Minutes special on population on Sunday night, and look, I have to say, it was gripping. They had an infographic with Australia so crowded that people were falling off the edges, you know, definitely drowning, not waving. Dick Smith was flying around in a helicopter pointing out, you know, new housing and high-rises and basically saying, "We are concreting over this country." Well, it does sound very alarming. But right now, our very low population density, about 3.5 people per square kilometre, makes us just a little bit more crowded than Mongolia. Okay, we've got limited arable land and we've got a concentration in the coastal cities, and everyone is absolutely correct to say that our rate of growth at 1.6% per annum makes us, you know, a world leader in rates of growth compared to other developed countries. But our base population is much lower. On that measure, we rank 55th. So our extra 400,000 people in a very big year is dwarfed by the 2.3 million extra Americans in the United States, for instance, almost a new Australia every decade, and their country is already 11 times denser than ours. If America stopped growing tomorrow, we'd catch up in terms of density in around 700 years. But why do we need to grow at all, some people ask, except for, you know, the economy? It is actually a good question, and the demographers tell us that our long-held population policy, based on immigration topping up natural population growth, has been about right. It's designed to offset our ageing population and diminishing tax base by keeping permanent migration at around 190,000, although, of course, we haven't been reaching that in recent years. At this level, we boost our skilled workforce, support family reunions in the community, and accept a small share of the world's refugees. Now, the important figure, of course, is the net overseas migration, total temporary and permanent migrants, plus returning Australians, minus people who leave. And this fluctuates, but reached a high of 300,000 a decade ago. We're around 236,000 today. Cutting the permanent intake won't necessarily bring down this number. But more importantly, it's very hard to see what it's going to do for, say, Sydney's traffic. Despite taking a lot of the growth over the last decade, government data shows us that average commuting times in Sydney and Melbourne have actually stabilised over the decade, and if anything, there's been a small decline. And that's because cities adapt to change. As we've seen in Sydney with employers moving towards business parks and suburban centres, we've seen our economic geography shift towards Parramatta. Doesn't mean we ignore congestion, but to fix congestion, we need to reduce car dependency rather than immigration. Australian cities were built around the private motor car, and it's not easy to change. But as we mature, we need to redesign around public transport and create walkable, cyclable neighbourhoods and well-connected centres. The real problem isn't how many people, but how we distribute growth. And in Australia, we are unbalanced. Sydney and Melbourne have grown by natural advantage in a global economy that favours cities for their deep skilled labour pools. But the Planning Institute of Australia says we need a national settlement strategy, like most other grown-up countries, to address this imbalance and to improve regional quality of life. It's not about forcing people to regions, but attracting and keeping them with decent transport, universities, hospitals, proper environmental policies, and of course, a functional NBN. But in calling out for sensible policy, no one seems to be listening. And should we really be surprised? Say, national settlement strategy and the gentleman in the front row has fallen asleep. But blaming migrants for the housing market, now that's a headline. The Daily Telly knows how to sell policy, and, you know, planners might need to take a lesson. Before migrants, planners cop the blame for housing, and of course, until it turned out that instead of blocking population growth and pushing up prices, they'd let through a tsunami of high-rise apartments. I'm trying to talk like the Daily Telly now. But prices kept climbing, fuelled by easy finance, lower interest rates, and of course, tax incentives for property investment. It's time to stop scapegoating immigrants for previous policy neglect, and time to make sure that real urban housing and environmental problems can't be used as a front for racist sentiment. Thank you.
Professor Nicole Gurran, an urban planner from the University of Sydney. Earlier you heard from environmental scientist Dr. Jonathan Sebels. This is the IQ Squared debate hosted by Dr. Simon Longstaff from the Ethics Centre. The question for debate, should we curb immigration? The next two speakers are Anne Ali, the Labor member for Cowan in Western Australia, and Satya Maya, writer and director of policy at the Australian Taxpayers Alliance.
Last Australia Day, my Indonesian friend called me a Malacca because I didn't bring enough hummus to the barbecue. So the question is, why is this Indian-Australian Malacca trying to tell you that we need to curb immigration? Let me start off by saying that we've been lied to and we've been failed by our governments at every single level. On this, both myself and the last speaker can agree completely. And this cuts across all divides, Liberal, Labour, Federal, State, you name it. Case in point, we've been told that this country has never had a recession since 1991, when in actual fact, that's based on the raw GDP figure. If you adjust it to per capita and take out the influence of population growth driven mostly by mass immigration, you find that we've actually had two per capita recessions in the last 28 years. So immigration is now this tool for the government to sell us this fake story about how life is getting much better for us when our own lived experience says otherwise. Over 200,000 people come to this country every single year. Majority of them, certainly half, settle mainly in Sydney and Melbourne. We might have a ton of space, but the fact is that for the moment at least, most of our jobs, most of our opportunities lie within these two big cities. And of course, that's going to have flow-on effects. Of course, your commute times are going to get longer. And while Nicole might have been correct that they've actually slowed down slightly in the last few decades or years, according to Infrastructure Australia, under the best case scenario from 2016 to 2044 in Melbourne and Sydney, your commute time is going to get longer, your house is going to get more expensive, and there's going to be a lot more stress on schools, hospitals, and other forms of infrastructure. We can talk about moving people to regional areas, but what are they going to do there? There's almost no economy in most of these places. The high quality jobs that our young people have come to expect to be a part of simply aren't being developed there. Now, we can talk about developing these places, but this is a long-term strategy. And that is the biggest problem. The fact that we've trusted our governments for over 20 years to predict what the effects of massive population growth will be. We've trusted them to plan and put into place the infrastructure and everything that we need so that we can have a society that functions effectively and well, even 10, even 20 years in the future. And they've failed us every single time. And we think that they'll wake up tomorrow and they'll do the right thing all of a sudden. It's not going to work that way. The truth is, governments are terrible planners, even at the best of times. Look at the budget forecasts every year. There's a 5-year or a 10-year prediction that comes out in the budget papers about what the economy will look like and whether we'll end up with a surplus. And even those, put together by some very smart people in the Treasury, are almost always inaccurate and overtly optimistic. And of course they're going to be, because there's so many contingencies and variables that are hard to account for when change is happening rapidly and there are tons of variables. And that becomes even harder when you have over 200,000 people coming into your country. And even now we're lagging, you know, consistently far behind in being able to cater for that. The other issue over here is not only that immigration is being used as a weaponized tool by the governments to, one, pretend that our economic growth is strong, but two, to focus on the small 15,000 component of our refugee program sometimes to argue that this is a huge issue, while often the same politicians who've made an issue out of the 15,000 end up increasing the 200,000 further and further, as has happened over the last two decades or so. We have to wean them off this addiction. We have to ensure that they are able to put the policies and the infrastructure in place first, and that we're able to pay for it and sustain it before we continue this over-dependency, this over-reliance on an insanely high rate of immigration. The other thing is this: we're told we need skilled workers to support our economy, and we do. But in the same week that you see an opinion piece from industry saying that we have skill shortages in STEM fields that we need and we can't cut skilled immigration, you find an article that reveals that the unemployment rate among STEM grads is actually some of the highest in the country of any discipline. A vast majority of them end up working in jobs which actually have nothing to do mainly with their degree. Meanwhile, it's quite easy for companies to bring in skilled workers with better experience who have often got uni degrees where they are more job ready for the economy. And why would they then invest tons of money and time in training up our young people and training up our homegrown graduates when this is an easy fix? We're in this perverse situation where we're putting a Band-Aid on a cancer tumor, and immigration is unfortunately, for no fault of the immigrant, preventing us from having these serious conversations and fixing this problem. The other issue is political factors. So the same polls that come out saying that over 82% of people in this country think immigration is a net positive, every single major poll of people, whether they're Labour, Liberal, or Greens, shows that a majority, including young and old, think our current rate of immigration is too high, based on all those frustrations I outlined before, which I'm sure you all agree are legitimate frustrations. And it is not simply the immigration itself. It obviously is the intersection between the failures of planning and immigration. But clearly the two of them intersect. Clearly we must find a way that we can accurately get one thing right before we then continue on with the other thing. And the issue is that there's a small but significant minority here who are losing trust and faith in the system, losing trust and faith in the major parties, and they're voting for parties like One Nation, which are anti-immigration, and which tend to be extreme in their positions, because they're fed up and they're frustrated. And what are they going to do when they feel that neither major party is adequately addressing their frustrations and good faith? They're going to go to the extremes. The time has come now for the sensible center in this country to reclaim that middle ground and bring people back there. And we can only do that if we have a frank and honest conversation about our immigration rate and how it can be transformed in a way that preserves our quality of life for both native Australians as well as the immigrants, including myself and my family, who've come to call this country home. There's a reason why multicultural societies like Dubai and Hong Kong are different to Australia. Because over here, when you come here, you benefit from the Australian way of life. You don't just benefit from economic opportunity. You benefit from the idea of this country. And droves of immigrants have come here, and they've been a part of that amazing, beautiful success story. This is a country where you grow your roots. It means something to be Australian. It isn't simply an economic experiment where we have an insane level of people coming to this country without the infrastructure, services, or the social cohesion that we need to make sure that we're all on the same page, part of the same project. And until we've fixed that mix right, this way of life that you and I have all come to love is genuinely under threat. Our politics are more likely to get polarized and divisive. Let's reclaim the ground. Let's do the right thing. Let's make immigration work for our country, as it always has. And then we will build a better Australia together, all of us. Thanks.
Dr. Anne Arley is the Labor member for the West Australian electorate of Cowan and also the first Australian female Muslim parliamentarian in our federal parliament, I think in any parliament. In her former academic life, she was a professor at Edith Cowan University, where she became an acknowledged expert in counterterrorism and de-radicalisation. Please welcome Dr. Arley.
You know, it's often said that we're a country of immigrants, the most successful multicultural nation in the world. And with around one third of Australians being born overseas, we really, really couldn't argue with that, could we? But you know, debates on immigration aren't new to this country. In fact, the discourse on immigration, and indeed the discursive construction of immigrants, has been and continues to be a defining feature of our media, political and public discourse. As much a staple of political debates as it is the source of friction at those awkward family dinners. Sometimes there's not much difference between a political debate and an awkward family dinner. And just as immigration is part of our national identity, so too, I would argue, is the debate about the size and nature of that immigration. And so it has ever been. Today, we find ourselves in a turbulent and rapidly changing world. The world seems smaller. People move faster and with ease to and from countries. We're experiencing the biggest displacement of people since World War II. And in 2017, there were 258 million people living outside their country of birth. That's around 3.4% of the global population. These trends are bound to direct attention to the rates of immigration, and indeed they have, inviting scrutiny and, for some people, the same expressions of anxiety that have persisted in this country for two centuries. At the end of the 19th century, immigrants to Australia also found themselves in a turbulent and rapidly changing world. As new immigrants in a vast, often perplexing and underpopulated continent, they were increasingly aware that they lived in a crowded and predominantly Asian neighbourhood. Since the 1800s, cultural anxiety about immigration and immigrants has been described variably in terms of a peril, a menace, an evil, a wave, a tide or influx poised to invade, inundate, swamp or flood. Australia and annihilate, oppress, obliterate or penetrate the invisible rabbit-proof fences of racial and cultural homogeneity, the myth of a white Australia. And recently, some political figures have called for a halt to immigration. And I won't get into those fringe politics, we all know who they are, of those who call for an end to immigration from certain countries, but I will continue on the premise of Australia's long-standing bipartisan commitment to a non-discriminatory immigration policy. Some have suggested that we need to curb immigration because we have experienced a 1.7% growth in our population between 2016 and 2017. But according to the World Bank, that places us 86th on the highest list of growing populations in the world. But it would be wrong to continue the discussion without considering this one salient point. The discussion about immigration in Australia has never been just about numbers of people coming here. When we have fervent discussions about immigration, invariably those discussions conjure equally fervent debates about housing, water, assimilation, integration, jobs, health, services, traffic, security, terrorism, crime, education, Muslims, Asians, Chinese takeovers. But let's just stop for a minute. Let's just hit the pause button. Let's all take a collective breath and let's actually talk about immigration. Much of our population growth is not from permanent immigration. The most recent data confirms that net temporary migrants to Australia far outweigh our permanent immigration. There are nearly 1.6 temporary migrants in Australia, and that includes students, around a quarter. That's our third highest export. Working holiday makers, temporary skilled migrants make up 10%, and New Zealand resident in Australia make up 40%. Temporary migration is subject to market forces like the economy and business needs and the value of the Australian dollar. It's not affected by government immigration policies that cut permanent migration. Now, my parents were immigrants, as was I. I came to Australia when I was two. I've tried to imagine what it was like for them, leaving everything they had and everything they knew behind to come to this country so, so far away. Had they been allowed to migrate today, they would have left a country, Egypt, of around 1 million square kilometres in size, with just under 3% arable land and a population density of around 80 people per square kilometre. And they would have left that to land right here in Albury-Wodonga, in a land or in a country of 7.6 million square kilometres, with just over 6% arable land and a population density of just under 3 people per square kilometre. And even so, there would have been people standing at the shores, waving their arms and shouting, "Go back! We're full! Go back, we're full." But temporary immigration and natural increases account for 80% of population growth and are largely unaffected by cuts to immigration programs. We're full. But the Productivity Commission estimated that GDP per person would be around 7% higher in 2060 if current migration rates were maintained, compared to a zero net overseas migration scenario. And the IMF estimates that Australia's current migration program will add between half to a full percentage point to annual GDP growth over the next 30 years by countering the economic impact of our ageing population. We're full! But experts continuously point out that reducing immigration will not reduce congestion in our big cities. If anything, it may prove counterproductive by making it harder to build the new infrastructure that would actually reduce congestion. But we're full. But we're an aging population with fewer babies being born. I'm still waiting for grandchildren. And we face a very real crisis of being unable to match labour demands with supply over the next decade. If we don't keep our rates of immigration constant over the next decade, the number of workers under the age of 35 will fall by over 500,000. We don't need to curb immigration. In fact, doing so would be counterproductive to growth. And while we can set the number of migrants and the selection criteria, the factors that drive the supply of migrants, particularly temporary migrants, are largely beyond our control and unaffected by immigration policy. We don't need to curb immigration, but we do need to rethink it. We need to recalibrate how we talk about immigration and, by default, immigrants. We need to address infrastructure and service needs without beating the populist drum that lays the blame for congestion and hospital waiting times and overcrowded schools squarely at the feet of immigrants. We need to discuss the pressures on our cities and the inequities in our population distribution without putting the burden on migrants. And we need to stop thinking about immigration as a celebration of a bit of soy sauce on your sausage roll and the fact that you can grab some Kung Pao chicken from the Chinese takeaway down the road. And I want to finish by sharing a story, a successful story of Australia's immigration, but I need your help on this one. So I need you to pull out your phones. Yeah, I know they told you to put them away, but I'm the boss for another minute. I need you to pull out your phones and I need you to turn on your camera. And I need you to hold your phones up. Make sure you turn it around on selfie mode. And I need you all to say cheese. If you want to know about how immigration has contributed to Australia, take a look at that picture, because you are the proof. Thank you.
The final speaker for the negative team, Anne Arley, the Labor member for Cowan in Western Australia. And earlier, for the affirmative, Satya Maya, writer and director of policy at the Australian Taxpayers Alliance.
You're listening to Big Ideas on RN with Paul Barclay.
This is the IQ Squared debate on immigration, hosted by Dr. Simon Longstaff. Simon now invites questions from the audience.
It just occurred to me that what makes the argument a little bit confusing to follow is that we've taken off the element of time. So we're arguing the moral case for immigration, whereas I think if we locate it in what the Prime Minister has just done, it's a pause button, admitting that we haven't actually planned population properly and therefore we're starting to do that now. And as a first measure, we might do well to cut it while we're figuring that out. Do you think that while we're accusing politicians of politicizing immigration, that we in fact are not capable of talking about immigration in a non-political sense because we've just brought in racism and all these other elements that somehow make people feel guilty about even thinking about the possibility that we might need to like stem the bleeding a little bit, if you will, because we haven't planned for it?
Thank you. Yeah, no, please applaud people who ask questions too. Yeah, absolutely. So, Nicole, this is really getting to the nub of it in some ways from your opponent's argument that they're not against immigrants or immigration. It's a pause. Let's get things settled. And we don't have to invoke racism or other concerns to have the argument. So do you want to have a stab at answering this comment and question?
Yeah, look, the issue is that we've known how to deal with, incidentally, I should correct one common misconception. Of course, Australia has had a population policy for a very long time. I mean, it underpins our migration, our approach, our non-discriminatory approach to migration, and our decision to top up natural increases in the population with immigration. So we have had a population policy. What we haven't had, and what we're long overdue for, is actually a national settlement strategy. And I just don't know what putting the pause on, you know, a very moderate process of some skilled migrants, some family reunions, and some refugees is going to do when it comes to sensible regional and city policies. So I think we start wondering about racism, firstly, because it's clear that actually there is some racism in the Australian community. And, you know, some remarks recently, for instance, about the housing market, I heard as a slap on the face. And not because I've got a PhD, but because actually I hadn't realised how much people had been just able to attribute, you know, the housing market to racism. So that's there, and it's not surprising that it's difficult to talk about population in cities without talking about racism while we don't deal with racism. But how much time do we need to plan properly for regional growth and for our cities.
Are you saying no time?
Well, look, the first thing that you say when someone comes into my planning class, you know, the first thing that we say is, look, you're a planner, you can't stop the city growing while you go away and do your plans. And, you know, that's meant as a joke. It's like the buses would drive on time if they didn't have to pick up passengers, you know. Planners, we're in the business of dealing with population growth and change, and actually, it's just as difficult to plan for a population that's declining. It's probably even more so. Just ask the regions. In fact, that's why we haven't been able to get regional development right. But we did give up the space in the 70s and we left it to the market, and the market took us to Sydney and Melbourne, and we do need to start offsetting that now. If we curb immigration, that's going to be more difficult.
My name is Lave. Just regarding what the against team said towards the end regarding improving our infrastructure may not be done without an increase in immigration to do so. Well, we have a lot of unemployed in Australia. Why are there not initiatives put forth by the government to have them be trained up and put into the industry to build the infrastructure? I feel like we're importing more for reasons that aren't the most founded in logic. For example, you mentioned we have a declining population. Why aren't there initiatives for having children? Why aren't there initiatives for setting down roots? Why is there a stray away from the culture that my parents had and my mother migrated towards in Australia for?
I want to kind of answer that in a roundabout way by starting with the first questioner who asked, you know, why can't we just have a conversation about immigration? We are primed in this country. We are primed with 200 years of consistent discussion about immigration that does not just focus on immigration. We are primed in this country to blame immigration for all our woes and deflect from our own responsibilities to do things like properly fund a TAFE system so that young people can be trained to take those jobs that are available, to fund infrastructure, to find solutions, to not pollute our waterways. So we're primed to continually blame immigration for this. And this is one of the points that I was trying to make in my talk, is that we can set parameters for permanent immigration, but by and large, that's not going to affect temporary immigration, which is hugely around market forces.
Can you move on to Laith's question now?
So I'm trying to get to the crux of your question, Laith, is, you know, why don't we train up people? I would agree with you. Why don't we train up people to take over the infrastructure jobs? But I don't see that as an argument for or against stopping immigration. The fact that we're not training up our young people to take up the jobs doesn't mean we turn around and blame immigration and blame immigrants for taking the jobs. This is an eternal kind of circular conversation that we keep having in Australia. Whenever these things come up, let's blame the immigrants for it.
I think Australia likes to perceive of itself as a global citizen, and I dare say we all benefit from it. So to respond to the, you know, I'm sure fine gentleman down the front who wanted to say he cared about his standard of living, I dare say that standard of living is bolstered by being a global citizen through trade, good positive foreign relations, the ability to travel effectively without borders because our passport is so great. My perception of immigration is that that's part and parcel of that global relationship. So my question for the fourth side is, why do we get to accept all the good bits of being a global citizen, but then when it comes to our commute in the morning or whatever other trivial things we want to care about, obviously some aren't always trivial, and I just picked the one that was, but when it comes to that, why do we get to say no? As Anne said, the walls are up, we're full.
Yeah, look, I completely contest the assumption that we're somehow being selfish by looking out for our own country before we do the rest of the world. This is the norm for every single country in the entire world. We are a strong global citizen. This country is known for the amount of foreign aid it gives out and for private donations to foreign charities especially. And we have a generous refugee program. Only Canada, in terms of ratio to population, takes in more people.
You've been to Jordan? I think Jordan takes a lot more refugees than we do, as does Lebanon.
Yeah, but are they able to provide them the same standard of living and the same services that we provide them? Probably not.
What, locking them up somewhere?
I'm not...
I'm just making that observation.
I'm not having an argument about offshore detention, but the fact is, for the 15,000 people who we do take in and we give a place, we are generous compared to most developed countries, and we absolutely should continue to make sure that our relationship with the rest of the world works the interests of our own people, especially our poor and our middle class, who are the most affected by long commute times and by congestion and by our lack of access to public education and other services that are put under strain.
Satya Maya on the affirmative team for the debate, Should We Curb Immigration? Moderator Simon Longstaff now invites each speaker to make their concluding remarks, beginning with Anne Ali.
Thank you, Simon. I just wanted to respond to your question that the burden of immigration is often borne by the poor and those who can least afford it. I would say that the burden of a lot of things is often borne by the poor and those who can least afford it. That's not immigration, that's inequality.
Okay.
Thank you.
Would you like to continue? Because you have more.
That's all I've got to say. And mic drop.
Jonathan Sobels, you get a chance now to respond to an unanswered question or to make some additional remarks.
Thank you. I'd like to answer the last question here about steps that we can take in our daily life. Most of them we're already doing. Sydney has achieved 40% improvement in its efficiency of water use over the last 25 years, but it's still got to keep going. We can grow more of our own food and take more interest in our local food production systems rather than have logistics operations which are national and indeed international control what we eat. You only have to look at the recent strawberry problems with needles to see the enormous waste of food that resulted from three needles in a strawberry punnet. We suffer because of the nature of our food distribution systems, which in themselves waste over 30% of our total food production, which is just crazy. Of course, if you do have the opportunity to take public transport, do so. If you can ride a bicycle, I do, do so. Recycling, we are well set up for that. The problem is the absolute number of people that we have contributing all these waste products to our environment. We expect the environment to be able to cope. It needs help, and we need to be the ones who make the changes, and part of those changes is to acknowledge the root cause of things like pollution to be simply the number of people we have in particular locations, because it's the concentration of these things that is the problem.
I don't want to set you up here, but do you think that if we changed our mindset, deployed our best technologies, we could change that and have more people because we have a lighter footprint because of that?
There's always, for me, a dissonance between expecting technology to be able to solve our problems. It's behavioural change, more often than not, that can make the difference, because you need lots of people to do small things that cumulatively have a massive impact. Technologies tend to be engineered, they tend to have point source centralisation, and centralisation is a really bad idea.
Okay, thank you. Nicole, your 2 minutes begins now.
Look, politicians fail. You know, both sides have said that tonight. But we've got to get them stopping blaming immigrants for the failures. Not actually because we're worried about racism, though I am, but because that leads to urban policy, housing policy, environmental policy, in my view, solutions that just don't work. Mm. If we are worried about concentrated, unbalanced city development, then let's invest in regional Australia. At least, you know, connect them to the cities with better transport infrastructure. Again, if we want to fix traffic, invest in public transport. You know, the urban density around it, make those places better too. If we want to fix the housing market, we need to redirect investment subsidies to affordable housing supply. Mm. We'll talk about a whole lot of other things there too. But cutting immigration just doesn't make that list.
What about, I would put the same challenge back on the notion of the natural environment. I imagine there must be a point at which the burden of humanity on this continent is such that it begins to falter and suffer. Is your argument, yes, that must be true, but we're not there yet, or is it that that's not true, that there will never be a point where we, I won't use it as colourfully as Anne did, but that we are actually full, at least in terms of our environmental services?
Look, I'm not pretending that the environment is elastic, and I will defer to an environmental scientist when it comes to fundamental limits in a particular system. But my job as a planner and the job of our political leaders is to help us adapt and change our behaviour to fit within the constraints that we have. And until we start doing that in the built environment, that means shifting to zero carbon development. It does mean, I'm afraid, for the selfish people, but this is coming anyway, immigration or otherwise, it does mean changing the way that we live, you know. Our households are getting smaller, but our houses have gotten bigger. You know, we're not embedding renewable energy in our local infrastructure. We're not collecting water, saving water. We're not reducing waste, reusing waste. We've got examples, Barangaroo. We've got Central Park down the road. We know how to do sustainable, you know, development with a very minimal footprint. Mm-hmm. And until we start embedding those models, actually asking the market to start performing, I just think it's fiddling around the edges, you know, to talk about anything
else. Thank you. The final word in this is going to come to you, Satya Mara. Your 2 minutes begins now.
Look, I think we're all in agreement that immigration has been a massive part of this country's success story and should continue to be. And I don't think there's anyone here on this panel who thinks that immigrants as individuals are somehow to blame for any of these problems. Most of us agree broadly that a number of failures on the part of our governments and decision makers have been to blame. Now, when you have decision makers pulling these levers of town planning and immigration, you know, in what is clearly not an open or free market, when you have that happening, often these are decisions that take a very long time to manifest in any shape or form. The idea isn't to curb immigration for good and to give in to the bigots or the people who want to do that. The idea is to manage it so we can make the right decisions on the planning front, so we can make the right decisions on the development front. Now, we do have the people in this country who you might think are selfish or are bigots or racist, but guess what? They have the same vote that you or I have. They're going to that ballot box and they're making their frustrations felt. And every year, more and more, that frustration is increasing. It's not going down. This is a reality that we have to understand. Now, what you do is you take those people and you bring them with you. You show them that immigration can work in this country's interest as it usually has. Maybe the economy will slow down if we curb immigration. And they'll say, you know what? I can see this now. I didn't see it before. And that's how we have a reasonable, nuanced conversation on this. And we ensure that immigration continues to work for all of us.
Satya Mara, the Director of Policy at the Australian Taxpayers Alliance. You've been listening to the IQ Squared debate from the Sydney Town Hall. The other speakers were Anne Ali, the Labor Member for Cowan in Western Australia, Professor Nicole Gurran, an urban planner from the University of Sydney, environmental scientist Dr. Jonathan Sibbels, a senior research fellow at the University of South Australia. The IQ audience is polled before and after the debate to determine the winner. Before hearing the arguments, 60% of the audience voted against the proposition that Australia should curb immigration. By the end of the debate, that number had increased to 77%. A decisive win for the negative team. You've been listening to Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.